This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to the Intelligence Squared podcast. This week's episode comes from our recent event at the Saatchi Gallery, Me, Myself, and I, Self-Expression in the Digital Age. A panel from the worlds of cultural criticism, social media, and neuroscience came together to discuss the wide-reaching impact of selfie culture on the world today. This event was produced in partnership with the Saatchi Gallery and Huawei. We hope you enjoy listening.
Thank you ever so much. I'm really delighted to be your host this evening. I'm a broadcaster and journalist. And what fascinating times we live in. As we just heard, self-portraiture is nothing new, nor is the self-obsession that we see today. In fact, anthropologists argue that that is a critical element of human development and human evolution. Nevertheless, in recent years and at breakneck speed, we've seen this twin development, the smartphone and social media. And together they've created an extraordinary cultural phenomenon, the selfie. And whether we like it or not, it is changing the very way that we view our society before our very eyes. The term selfie was entered into the Oxford English Dictionary in 2013. Just 2 years later, it was reported that more people were dying taking selfies than were being attacked by sharks. So there you are. And we literally upload hundreds of billions of these things every single year. This amazing exhibition, which I hope you've all had the chance to have a look at, explores that, and it reminds us that this has unleashed incredible creative self-expression, all sorts of potential for making art. But what is driving that mania, and what effect is selfie culture having on us, both as individuals and also as a society? Well, those are just two of the questions, hopefully among many more, that we'll be exploring tonight. And I'm really delighted, and thank you to Intelligence Square and Huawei and the Saatchi Gallery for convening such a stellar panel this evening. On my left, we have Will Storr. He is an award-winning journalist and novelist. He's written for the Sunday Times magazine, The Guardian Weekend, and The New Yorker. And he's written a fantastic new book called Selfie, How We Became So Self-Obsessed and What It's Doing to Us. It is on sale in the gallery bookshop, and it's a fantastic read. Slightly terrifying as well, but in a good way. Then we have Sarah Diefenbach, and we're very grateful to Sarah. She's come all the way from Munich just this afternoon to be with us on the panel this evening. She's Professor of Market and Consumer Psychology at the Ludwig Maximilians University in Munich. And among her areas of research are the side effects of technology use on happiness and the psychological effects of social media on our happiness and well-being. So some fascinating research there. Then we have Pandora Sykes. She is a broadcaster and podcast host and journalist. Until recently, she was at the Sunday Times Style magazine as wardrobe mistress. But she also hosts the fantastic weekly podcast, The High Low. That's a mixture of pop culture and news, and it's absolutely top of my podcast list every week. So lovely to have you, Pandora. And finally, last but not least, we have Alex Lambrecht. He is a leading fashion, lifestyle, and documentary photographer. He's known for his black and white street style documentary photographs, which he applies to fashion, advertising, and editorial campaigns. He's also photographic director of The Fall magazine and a regular contributor to Leica's magazine, Leica Photography International. So welcome to you all, and thank you very much indeed for being here. I want to start by asking you a quick question, each of you. Will, first of all, is selfie culture anything new?
Not really. I mean, obviously, this exhibition, this amazing exhibition, begins in the 16th century. But for me, the story really begins 2,500 years ago in ancient Greece, which is where the kind of Western personality came into being. And it's where this idea of Western individualism sort of really came up. So that's where I'd kind of pin the beginning of that story.
Excellent. Well, we'll be talking more about that shortly. Sarah, though, you've, in your research, identified something very fascinating called the selfie paradox. Briefly, what is it?
Well, the selfie paradox, it described the ambivalent attitude towards selfies in our society. And the seemingly contradictory finding that if you ask people whether they like the many selfies on social media, most of them, 82% we found, say they would love to see more usual pictures and less selfies in social media. But at the same time, everybody is contributing and 77% are regularly taking selfies. So this may be, look paradox, but my research then explores the psychological reasons behind it, and I think I can tell more about this later, what may be the reason for such findings.
Oh, we're looking forward to hearing it then. Human beings, very contradictory animals. Pandora, perhaps you can tell us, is there a conflict between feminism and selfie culture?
Nice, light question.
just, in a sentence or two, if you will.
I think the difficulty when you're talking about anything relating to feminism now is that there is no fixed definition. As bell hooks said, it is everything and nothing. So it does depend, I think, on whether or not you see feminism as a collective goal, whether or not you should be working towards something that benefits all women, or whether or not you see it as an individual empowerment and choice. If it's the former, then I would argue that you could be fairly powerful for a young girl, particularly a teenager, to be the architect of her own image in the public forum, which is not something she has much control over in the rest of society. But on the other hand, if you're taking 400 selfies a day, you don't have time to do anything else, feminist or otherwise. I think that a lot of the time, selfies... for people to say that taking a selfie or a nude selfie, which is, a nudie. We've even seen a bushy. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that, but I have.
I'm not sure that one's entered the Oxford English Dictionary yet, but
if Amber Rose has her way, it will. A lot of these women are saying that, this is my feminist right. I don't think selfies are inherently feminist or anti-feminist, but I think there's a lot of interesting debate in between.
There certainly is, and we will be coming back to that very question. And Alex, finally, technology has developed so quickly in the last few years. Anyone can now be an artist, but what does that mean for selfies as a legitimate form of photographic art, and how do we take it to the next level?
Okay, nice. Another light question. I guess, there's a couple of words that you mentioned. Let's say the artist and the artwork and taking it to that level. It all comes down to the message. And I think one thing that separates the selfie from other forms of photography is that it almost inherently implies that we're going to share it with someone, that it's been taken for a purpose of not to look... I'm not so sure. Maybe a lot of people take selfies to look at themselves and ponder it. But to me, it appears that perhaps they're being taken to be shared either globally amongst friends or like nudies with your partner or... I think that there's something there, but the most important part in coming back to art and why we take photos, there are two messages there. Firstly, as a photographer, whether it's going to be a selfie or it's an image of a landscape or something or other, there's a message, and inherently in becoming a photographer and taking a message, you're implying that you have a message that is worthy of adoration, or your message is worthy of raising a question, that you have an opinion that matters. And when you're taking a selfie, you're also raising a question, you're saying something. So there's a kind of the message is the most important part. And I think that's what art comes down to. Art is really, it's a subjective argument I could have probably in this gallery for days. It really comes down to what is the message, what's the importance of the message, is there one, is it going to be Zen art where it's, I'm just going to let it develop itself, or do I have something that I want to say? So.
Well, that's fascinating, and it comes right back to one of the central premises of your book, Will, which was that for years and years, human beings were dependent on their own sense of self-reflection to work out who they were and what life was all about. And now we are hopelessly dependent on how we see ourselves reflected back. Less I think, therefore I am, and more I am what I think others think I am.
It's getting very complicated.
Isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting idea from psychology. It's this guy called Cooley's come up with this idea that it speaks to kind of how our brain, how our sense of self comes to decide who we are, what are we like, how do we, you know, how do we come to a judgment about our own worth? And that's the idea is that we are what we think other people think we are. It's a really powerful idea. So we aren't what we think we are. We aren't what other people think we are. We are what we imagine they think of us. So if we imagine, so if we put a selfie up on Instagram and everybody tells us we're wonderful and special, that is to an extent, but to an extent, going to make us feel that we are wonderful and special just in that moment. I'm sure Sarah's got some more to say about that subject. So that's a really sort of core idea from the psychological literature about how we understand ourselves. And I think it's really important way of sort of understanding why selfie taking can be such a kind of almost addictive activity.
And the technology obviously enables that in the way that, you know, Van Gogh did not have the possibility when he painted those self-portraits. Presumably he still wanted that to have an effect on his viewers and in some way be reflected back on him, but never have known.
I was thinking, as Alex was talking about what is art, what is photography, I suppose one definition of art is it's the expression of an emotion or an idea through another particular medium. And I would question, I would imagine that Van Gogh had some sort of really deep and interesting and kind of profound and powerful ideas he was trying to express through his painting that maybe aren't being expressed through, I don't know, Kim Kardashian's latest bummy, what's it called? A belfie.
Belfie.
I don't know. I mean, you know.
We've had the bushy, we've had to mention the belfie before too long.
But can we just stop on that point for a second? Yeah. If you think Van Gogh, it would take him maybe weeks or months to create this selfie, and then it'd take months or years for anybody to actually view it, whereas now we can take 25 selfies a minute.
Frequency.
We pick which one we like, we can post something, we get a negative reaction, quickly delete it, post a new one. So we're constantly reinventing ourselves, whereas maybe Van Gogh just was himself for a much longer period.
And and fundamentally, when one of the things we're looking at, I mean, when I was doing the research for selfie, there was this very famous psychological professor, Bruce Hood, and he said to me, you know, what are we doing as human beings in our adult lives? Once we've got enough money to look after our families and make a living, what we're just out doing there is trying to get validation. You know, that's why we write books. That's why we...
I hope not.
but on that very basic level, I mean, Van Gogh, Kim Kardashian...
Well, and also, artists that create self-portraits throughout their career. I was looking at one of the installations upstairs, and it's, you know, a photographer who's taken a picture of himself every single day and watching his face change over... I mean, in some ways, it's hard to argue that's any different from Rembrandt doing a series of self-portraits over the course of his life.
It comes back to the message, though.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Are they showing this to show other people, hey, I'm a normal person, so are you, and I'm trying to connect with you that way? Or are they taking the photo and saying, look at how much better looking I think than I am and how much I need your attention?
Yeah.
It's the message, not the actual
piece of art.
It feels
more important.
And you could have the exact same photo with 25,000 different messages.
Well, so we'll definitely talk about the difference between selfies that are made to make other people feel bad about themselves and selfies are made to make other people feel good about themselves and how that gets reflected back. But this leads so perfectly to you, Sarah, because you briefly talked about the selfie paradox, the idea that 90% of people don't like selfies, but when they do it, they're doing it in a self-ironic way, or they're doing it in somehow a witty and cool way. break it down for us a bit more. That research is fascinating, because there's also revelation in terms of what people think they are when they put selfies out, that they think they're better looking than people who don't take selfies. Or
Exactly, and I think it's really related to this message aspect, because what we did was that we asked people to judge their own selfies and other selfies. And what we found is that when you talk about other selfies, the majority, like 90%, says it's self-presentational, it's narcissistic. And when you judge your own selfies, you say it's funny, self-ironic, authentic. So you really see what you think your selfie might look for the others. It's not the impression you make. And in psychology, there are some theories that can explain this kind of behavior very well, like the self-serving bias, which means we construct stories about around our behavior that flatter us, and so you have a good justification for taking the selfie. And of course, it's also important that this is a non-conscious process. So in the end, you can never tell what is a true motivation behind the selfie. And I think that's also some of the magic of the selfie, because yeah, it's a playful way of self-presentation.
And that's a nice positive way of looking at it. And there are clearly positive things about this mode of self-expression. Yeah. You know, often in the media we read these stories about how, you know, there's anxiety levels are on the rise and self-harm levels are on the rise and all sorts of horrors for millennials, centennials, Generation Z, I think it's called. I'm really showing my age there, but I think it's Generation Z. But where do you guys stand on that? Because clearly there are lots of positive things that can come from this and an awful lot of negative things. Pandora, what have you seen along your travels, being the youngest person on this panel, I think, working among different generations? Overwhelmingly, do you think it's having a positive effect on a generation for whom it is just absolutely self-nature?
I think it's quite hard to isolate selfies because they are part, for me, I think they're just part of popular culture. They're part of social commentary. They don't exist just on their own. They are interwoven, I think, into lots of different aspects. I spoke to some teenagers recently and I was more perturbed by the fact that they were retouching their selfies than I was the fact that they were taking selfies. And I think that comes from the fact that we're seeing a very different kind of female aspiration, I don't think that's even quite make sense, to emerge. In the 90s, when I was young, it was Kate Moss, it was natural and knotty hair, and now what teenagers aspire to look like is something that is very modified. So I would be more scared by that than what they're necessarily doing on the surface. But I think it's interesting what you were saying about the message being different, because whilst I do think context is very important, and obviously there is nuance, when you are looking at a selfie, you're not seeing context. So when someone like Emily Ratajkowski, who's a model who has spoken a lot about why she can be a sexual and a serious being, and she can share a nude picture, and she's still, you know, she's a feminist, and this is a feminist act. And I have no doubt that her intention is a feminist one. But I think when you're looking at a selfie, you're not seeing context, motivation, intention. You are just seeing the sum of a woman's parts. And I take selfies myself. I don't deem them inherently good or inherently bad. But I think to suggest that a selfie is not literally showing a woman as a body, which is what she has historically struggled for our entire female existence with, is to perhaps give a little bit more credibility to your viewer. Because someone scrolling through on Instagram, for example, is not thinking what was going through their head right now, where were they taking it, why were they taking it. They're just going, boobs.
And quite often,
that's what I was thinking.
They're thinking, really nice, really enormous boobs, and I don't have those, therefore I can now feel really bad about myself.
That's a whole different thing. And I was really interested in your book, Will, to hear how you linked selfies to self-esteem and mental health.
Yeah.
It's really sad.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, I mean, you open with suicide.
It's not really a vote winner, is it? I open with lots of people killing themselves. Yeah, my editor was like, are you sure about this? But I think it's important because essentially it's called Selfie because it's also a book about the self. And for me, as somebody who has suffered kind of with suicidal ideation before, I've done a lot of reporting as a journalist with people who have survived suicide attempts and of parents and partners of people who have committed suicide. And for me, it was a really interesting puzzle. What is it about the human self? What is that thing that can force it to turn it against itself? And the one commonality I was hearing again and again and again was this idea of people having overly high expectations for really expecting to have this kind of perfect, amazing life. And when they fail again and again and again, that's when you start to see these really destructive behaviours. And in fact, I'm sure familiar, Professor Sarah, with Roy Baumeister's work, that the kind of model of suicidality. Mm-hmm. And he's, you know, there's a very famous idea of what, you know, causes people to get into that suicidal mode of thinking. And he talks about that exact thing. And then I spoke to this guy called Gordon Flett, who is a professor in Canada who studies perfectionism. And he said that something is changing in recent times. And he said it's not that we're becoming more perfectionistic as people, but our environment is becoming fuller of ways of making us feel like failures. Mm-hmm. So one of the ways you can, what you describe perfectionism or a perfectionist, is it's somebody that is overly sensitive to signals of failure in their environment. And what we've got in the current world is quite a harsh, hard, individualistic, neoliberal environment that is kind of quite full of opportunities for us to feel like failures. And that isn't just about selfies, it's about finding it hard to be a success in our careers, finding it hard to kind of adhere to these, to modern gender norms. It could be trying hard to get, you know, to have the perfect body. But it can also be, you know, Instagram. You know, they talk about this idea of perfectionist presentation on social media now, which is an idea we all put our perfect lives on social media. And of course, I mean, I know you've looked at that as well, haven't you, Sarah? This idea that even though we know other people are just putting these ridiculously perfect moments on Instagram, we know it's not real. It kind of feels real unconsciously, and it kind of knocks us
a bit. Well, I'm fascinated by that. Obviously, we are surrounded by this idea of fake news and the fact that everything is doctored, everything is modified. Where is the truth? What is the truth? Pandora, talk to us about the Finster phenomenon. You briefly alluded to it, whereby even though people know it's a modified image, they don't care about the reality because there's an amazing example of this in your book too, Will, that, you know, I won't say the word that she says, but, you know, sod the mirror, because the mirror's reality. This is Instagram. It can't be real.
Yeah, yeah. Your case study, CJ, she was riveting. I found when I spoke to one teenage girl, I said, but don't you mind if everyone knows you don't look like that? And she said, no, that's the whole point. Everyone knows what you look like. Why wouldn't I put a picture up where I can look different? And I think as well, I spoke to girls who had up to 5 different Instagram accounts. So they'd have one that their parents knew about, then they'd have one for their friends, and then they'd have one just for animal pictures. And it was extraordinary. And a full-time job as well, from the sounds of it. I think that the fake and that the filter thing is really interesting, and that's part of the reasons why I find Instagram stories quite problematic, because people like to use them because it's this unfiltered, like, on-the-go subtext to your life. But to me, I find them really scary because it just reminds me of The Truman Show, that it's suggesting that everything is worthy of documentation, that everything should be technicolor, and that we should aspire every day. Like, the average is, you know, something that we absolutely can't bear. But then the irony is that all of these huge vloggers like Zoella, who have emerged out of YouTube, have emerged because they've been fetishizing the average. They're doing their shop, they're eating dinner with their boyfriend, they're taking their dog for a walk, and that's what's getting them millions of views. So I think it is a slightly odd spiral where we've got Instagram stories because you can only share perfect moments on your Instagram, which is not something I believe in. It's why I don't do Instagram stories, because that idea of the curatorial I find quite scary. But then you've also got this whole other medium where you're like allowed to enjoy the average because it's not okay over here anymore. Which seems exhaustive.
A big trending thing on Instagram today. Are there any mums in the room? Any sort of my generation, you know, with toddlers in the room? No, you're all far too young. But something that was big on Instagram today was a reaction to a Daily Mail story in which there had been abuse against scummy mummies, the idea that you feed your kids fish fingers for tea and then maybe have a little glass of wine at the same time. Not that I'm guilty of that, obviously.
Sounds ideal.
And what had happened was that a lot of very influential mum Instagrammers, or Instagrammers who are human, who just happen to have children and be female and their mothers, I don't know what the correct terminology is anymore. It's definitely not Insta-mums, I didn't say that. They fought back. And the whole thing, they made a little video with Birdseye, as it happened, to basically say, for all the 5 p.m. Peppa Pig meltdowns, for all the, you know, gins consumed whilst feeding the kids, for all of this stuff, we're real, we're here for you, this is solidarity, sisters, you know, this is what we really look like, and this is what we really do. And I suppose the flip side of the social media phenomenon is that there is a role that it can play for making people feel better about themselves and actually saying, this isn't uncurate, you know. But the layers of artifice are genuinely staggering, because that's not any more real than, you know, Emily Ratajkowski or Kim Kardashian or CJ doctoring 400 pictures a night to get the perfect selfie.
Yeah, I wish it was. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, but I think that's interesting because I think that phenomenon you describe on Instagram today, there's also a flip side of that too. And, you know, I said at the beginning, the kind of the selfie world goes back 2,500 years, but really you can go back even further if you're looking at social media more broadly. And that's, you know, to our evolutionary history. And we've spent, you know, most of our time here on Earth as a tribal hunter-gatherer creature. You know, we are animals, we are apes, and we still think in those very tribal ways. And one of the things it means to be a human is to be tribal. And one of the things that we have in common with chimpanzees, who are, you know, along with bonobos, one of our closest relatives, is that we are tribal and we attack other groups. And the one thing you see on social media, I mean, social media is this sort of very new, bright, shiny phenomenon, but it's actually working on very, very ancient and quite dangerous circuits. And you know, so one of the things it means, well, there's two things. One thing that's true in primate tribes is there's a fluid hierarchy. So who's the leader is always going up and down. And in fact, in chimp tribes, it's 4 to 5 years they're at the top, and as we see that echoed in our electoral cycle. But what that means is that we're constantly alert to status. We're constantly worried about our relative status to everybody else. And so that we see that playing out on social media. But we also see the idea of one, you know, we live in in-groups. And I wasn't aware of the thing today, but, you know, that's our in-group, the mums, attacking the Daily Mail at the out-group. So you know, it feels great when it's people on our side. Mm. But, you know, one of the people who, you know, passed away, who I talk about in the first chapter of the book, is poor old Phoebe Connop, who was 18 and shared a picture privately on social media. And I don't know what the picture was, but she was worried she appeared as a racist. This picture escaped and she committed suicide. She's 18 years old. So that's the dark side of this same phenomena, it plays with these very dangerous and powerful kind of tribal instincts we have.
Sarah, you're nodding vigorously there.
Yeah, Rhiannon.
Does that tally with your research, your academic research into psychology?
Because I think it demonstrates very well that the needs people have, they have always been the same, so it has always been important for people to get recognition by others, to compare themselves. But nowadays with social media, the challenge is much bigger because you can compare yourself to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
And there will always be someone who's better in something. Of course, you don't get average insights, but very selective, high-polished views on the lives of others. So it's necessarily you will get the impression that others are better, happier than yourself. And so I think the selfie is just like the peak of the iceberg, and it's really taking this self-control and the urge to show a perfect image of yourself to the top, because already in the moment you're taking the photo, you have the control.
Is there an argument, though, to say that actually human beings have been doctoring their own image for 6,000 years? I mean, we know that the earliest cosmetics go right back to millennia. Pandora, I'd be interested. I'm coming to you, Alex, as well.
I've got to take notes, because there's quite a few things here I'd like to jump in on.
But that idea that actually, you know, we're used to airbrushing in glossy magazines, we're used to even, you know, the 1940s, the first era of the kind of moving image and movie stars, you know, we Vaseline on the lens or tights over the lens or whatever it might be. There have been moves to enhance the way we look for whatever reason, and a complicated litany of reasons for so long. What's the difference? What makes it more nefarious and more dangerous that Instagram or Finstagram has this kind of fake element to it, when actually you could say, well, I'm wearing mascara today, I don't really look like this, I've got a bit of blusher on, my, you know, how much more dangerous is it?
I think one of the reasons why we feel like we find it much more problematic is because in popular culture now, there are much more discussions happening around identity. Whether it's gender identity or sexual identity, we spend a lot of time identifying. And, you know, some psychologists say that, for me, for example, as a child of the baby boomer generation, we were encouraged to self-express and self-identify all over the shop. And I think a lot of the time you're seeing the output generationally of a generation encouraged to express. I think when you think about how you portray yourself and how it is consumed by other people, or viewed by other people, is two words always come to mind, I think, and that's where they can be in friction, is that it's both empowering and exploitative. So a American psychologist called Pamela Rutledge described Kim Kardashian's selfies as empowering for her but exploitative of her audience. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, I mean, it comes back to bring it back to feminism about the individual choice versus the collective benefit, is that in that moment, I think a selfie could be quite empowering. You know, there's nothing wrong with sharing, or at least I don't think it is, if there's anything wrong in sharing a picture where you feel good. You know, you want to preserve that moment, and there it goes up. But the ramifications that it can have on other people are obviously immeasurable. In terms of what I do find funny is when people, like you say, talk about kind of retouching and stuff like this now, because there have always been aspirational things to make women feel, I don't want to swear, rubbish about themselves. You know, Audrey Hepburn looking exceptional and also very, very thin, possibly and probably thin for most women in films. Marilyn Monroe, who we actually know had a really unhappy time for most of her film career, but, you know, was the pinup that everyone wanted to look like, the dream woman that inhabited herself. And I think that's what we'll always struggle with, is the woman inhabiting herself versus how you are interpreting that on the outside.
So the movie stars who are helped in all manner of ways to present a certain aspect of themselves that most ordinary women can't aspire to, either physiologically or financially,
or surgically.
Or surgically. Indeed, the whole Belfie thing, and apparently the rise of buttock extensions or buttock enlargements.
Every 30 minutes in the US, there's a bum implant.
There you go.
That's from the Sunday Times.
So that means that there have been two since we just sat down. How does that make you feel?
Buttock every 15 minutes.
I want to bring you in, I want to pick up on something that Pandora said about Instagram stories and this idea that everything is worth documenting. You are a documentary photographer.
One word that just keeps coming back in my mind every time I hear the word selfie, because this is the most I've actually heard it. I mean, we're saying it every 2 seconds. What actually comes, no offense to anybody who's talking, but the idea of it just keeps saying selfish. That's all I'm thinking is selfish, selfish, selfish. When we think about how am I going to look, I'm going to retouch myself, it all comes back to that message. I think that the idea, I think selfie culture at the moment is propagated by a number of things. Our obsession with fame, which is highly corrosive to all of us, you know, and the media's constant proliferation of bad photography, bad selfies that we're constantly seeing. I think when we get beyond and we start to, I mean, obviously I come from an art background, so I critique selfies. I critique all types of photography. Just because there's an overproliferation of a certain image doesn't make it a good image. Mm-hmm. And I think it's time for people to evolve beyond the infantile stage that we're at with what selfies are and what they mean to us selfishly and how they're corroding us. And it's time for artists to come in and say, hey, I'm going to use this selfie for something good. And I'm going to use the same ideology. It's going to still be a selfie, but the message is going to be different. And that, so I'm not as pessimistic, I'd like to think. I'm an optimist in just saying that we're in this stage right now where, because we're so obsessed with the fame, and that's going to be a bubble that's going to burst, and it's going to burst very quickly because things move. So I think things are moving really fast. I think when I say quickly, I don't know, 5-10 years, there's going to be a complete turnaround on it. You see on Instagram, influencers with over 1 million followers are worthless because they have no connection with anybody. A lot of brands are now looking for people even under 10,000 or even under 5,000 followers because they have a lot more connection. There's a lot more integrity in the posts that they're doing. There's a little bit more of a personal connection there in certain circles. And you know, someone can correct me if I'm wrong on that. And I think that it's going to happen quicker than people realize. And that bubble will burst and photographers will step up or artists will step up and use this medium to do something good and to do something great, and the message is going to change. But the selfie will be the same.
I just feel there might be generations of younger digital natives who are like, well, hang on a minute. If I take a photograph on my phone and it gets 10 million likes, why do you get to decide whether that's art or not?
You're not saying that it's art. It's only art if you say it is. You know, let's go back to that one, and that's been said so many times. I'm not here to requote someone, but what I come back to is the benevolence of art. You know, street photography, traditional forms of art photography, came out out of compassionate and benevolent means by artists to show other people the world, to share, not to say, look at how great I am.
Yeah.
And the selfies that we're seeing, the ones that we seem to be talking about now, and I hope, you know, and I'm happy to keep talking about them, but I kind of believe that there's a lot more in store for selfies. And when you walk around the exhibition downstairs, that's apparently evident, you know. I didn't see one down there where I went, oh, look at this poor knob who's just sitting there wanting me to look at how pretty she is. There's a lot of expression there. There's a lot of artists that have made an effort. And I think that it's time for the audience, and not this audience, I mean us as an audience, to become more educated and become better consumers and know what we're looking at, rather than just go, oh, what a bimbo, or what are this, or what are that.
I think the point, for me, I was thinking about the selfie bubble bursting, and I think definitely, I think, you know, we always see these things as cycles, that the more fashionable things become, the more unfashionable then they become, with the children of the people who endorse that thing grow up. But I think one of the sort of really interesting ideas that I came upon when I was researching my book was this idea, they call it the geography of thought, that comes out of psychology. And that says that kind of who we are is very much a product of, you know, initially ecology, but then economy. So the reason that we became individualists back in ancient Greece was because of the ecology. The ancient Greece is just a civilization of 1,000 different city-states. And it's all kind of mountains descending to sea and rocky islands. So to get along and get ahead in ancient Greece, you have to be an individual. You have to run a tiny industry. You have to hustle. You have to fish. You have to make olive oil. You've got to be a hustler. And then from that comes this kind of adoration of the individual, this kind of worship of the individual. And we still carry that kind of with us today. And the really interesting point, I think, in our recent history was in 1980, when after the kind of economic chaos of the 70s, Thatcher and Reagan come along with this, you know, to promote this idea of neoliberalism. So, okay, we're going to make human life into this great competition, like the Hunger Games. So get rid of the unions, get rid of all the red tape that means that companies and the welfare state have to look after people. Go, you're in competition now. And then very quickly, we start seeing really interesting things happening. So, you know, 1980s is when the Keep Fit revolution first begins, which has never left us. You know, Gym Fix in America, the green goddess over here. In 1982, you start seeing this thing in maternity wards, where parents for generations have given their children names like Arthur and Jennifer and Elizabeth. Suddenly, you see the beginnings of all this of unusual names. It was Professor Jean Twenge, who studies, a very famous psychologist in America, who studies the rise of narcissism. Because she revealed all this stuff in her work, and she said, you know, her reason for that was these parents wanted their children to stand out and be a star. So, you know, if who we had to be in ancient Greece to get along and get ahead was a hustler, that happens too, again, to in a much more concentrated way in 1980, and it never leaves us. And the other thing that happens in the 80s is it's the beginning of the self-esteem movement. And what the self-esteem movement did was it changed the way we raised our children, it changed the way we taught our children. And it was this crazy idea that in order to make more competitive young people to compete in the neoliberal game, in order to make them happy and successful, they just had to believe they were amazing. And as parents, we had to tell them they were amazing.
Yeah,
and as children, tell them they were amazing.
How did that work on your self-esteem, Will?
It was a disaster, because I was a terrible kid. I was a nightmare. I was like, I failed all my exams. I was an alcoholic. I got in trouble with the police. And, you know, I was in therapy in my 20s. And in therapy, they said, oh, it was because your parents didn't love you. You've got low self-esteem. And I believed all this stuff. And it was only a few years ago when I came across Baumeister's work, which kind of said, actually, this is all wrong. You know, none of this is right. Actually, it's really, you know, that's what triggered the book, because I thought, this is insane. You know, this is insane that I've been brought up with this kind of mad idea. And I think the interesting thing about the technology is I don't think that technology has changed really anything. Mm. What the technology has done is exposed who we are already. So when they launched the selfie camera in 2010, it wasn't called the selfie camera, it was called the front-facing camera. And the idea was that it was going to be good for Skype and FaceTime. We were going to talk to our nans in Italy.
Little
did
we know.
But that's not what we did with it. You know, and I think, so I think the bubble will burst, but I think it's going to, I think the roots of this are deep, and they're in our economy, so it's going to be a long change.
How universal are they? I'm very conscious that we're sitting here in the heart of Chelsea, we're having this conversation, you know, we're all of a certain, you know, presumably class and background, give or take.
Give or take.
What sort of differences do we see culturally when it comes to selfie? Because it clearly is a ubiquitous phenomenon. It's not just Western society. And in fact, I read that Philippine is the selfie capital of the world.
Amazing.
The Philippines is the selfie capital of the world. Sarah, perhaps you can talk to us about what you've seen in your research and how selfies work in different cultures.
Well, first, I would, if it's okay, just to jump up on this aspect, because I think the really important thing is that it's the technology is just a new way, a new medium, and then you have this self-intensifying process that, for example, a need like popularity comes to the fore, and then you can get addicted to this in a way, because you have this new opportunity which is very fast to get feedback from others, but on the same time you get more vulnerable because you could get negative feedback as well. And I think if you understand this, then it absolutely makes sense that I really liked your encouraging statement that we can see selfies also as a form of art, and we can make much more of it. But the challenge is really for people to have this conscious reflection: which are my needs, and which is a medium that I can use to fulfill this? And whether the selfie is always the best form for each message, you should discuss about this. And coming back to the question about different cultures, there are actually some studies in Asia that studied selfie motivations there, and also here in Germany we did some studies, and what we found there was quite interesting, that there are different needs or functions related to it, so that in some cultures, Asian cultures, it's more on this connective part, like we are doing a selfie together and we are celebrating us being together. What we found was more this self-presentational individual part. So
that's extraordinary, because part of what I do in selfies is I compare ancient Greek individualist ideas to East Asian Confucian ideas. And of course, In ancient Greeks, we were
It's a very learned book. Yes. In case you thought it was going to be filled with selfies.
And so the opposite of ancient Greece was, in a sense, East Asia, where it wasn't lots of mountains rolling to sea. It was great sort of low-lying plains and mountains. And so to get along and get ahead in East Asia, you had to be involved in a major irrigation project, a major rice farming project. So the group becomes most important.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating. I didn't know. I wish I knew. It'd be a bit of my book. That even in Asia, that reflects in the selfies they take, that it's all part of the group.
You can see that in Tokyo, though. When I was in Tokyo a few months ago, there's a lot of when they take selfies. It's that whole trope of all the schoolgirls taking selfies together. I didn't see one person taking one on their own.
That's fascinating.
I've got to say that when I was going through the exhibition, there were so many of the group selfies, and they're the ones that I connected with the most, or I felt much.
Because it's collaborative.
It just made me feel really warm. It's like,
And so I think that's where it comes back, that you see it's not the selfie or the medium, it's really what you make out of it. And
absolutely.
I just worry that we're very lazy, though, and if there's a button that helps with your depth of field, then you'll click the button. If there's a filter that does it for you, you'll click the filter. Yeah. You won't then take it offline and necessarily. Well, hopefully.
If that was the case, then people could just go and take my job as a photographer and push that button, and it's still. There's still always going to be that.
There certainly is.
And it's the intention. I want to do it.
Just to bring us back to the fact that we're here in this gallery, the Saatchi Gallery is the world's number one museum on social media. And I'm fascinated by, as we heard at the beginning, you know, this is the first time that the selfie has been put on walls in the same way that old masters are, and that it's treated as a credible, viable, important art form. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are, just to wrap us up before we open it out to the audience, on the role of exhibitions like this and the importance of capturing what is such a prevalent social, cultural zeitgeist on the walls of an art institution.
Yeah, I think it's incredibly interesting because it's so accessible in how you can relate it to what we're talking about in popular culture. I love that I like any kind of fusion of lowbrow or things that are deemed to be lowbrow and highbrow. So, you know, there's those guys that had wrapped up their faces in sellotape and taken a ridiculous selfie. It's literally my favourite. Or the man that made himself look like Jesus. You know, and that's something that would be seen as like a joke or a meme or something.
Or to say nothing of the woman who goes into airline toilets and makes herself look like a Quaker or a nun with like airline pillows and loo paper, which is genius of a sort.
It was something that can be seen to be seen as quite gimmicky or ephemeral, so I like seeing it aligned with Tracy Emin and Van Gogh and being able to appreciate it as a big movement, because I think people can be dismissive or quite narrow-minded about this is what this is, and I always enjoy when someone just goes, no, let's throw it all into the same and see how they all connect.
Van Gogh, of course, in his day was not exactly appreciated for the artist that he is now. Sarah, what are your thoughts?
I think it's great to have such exhibitions, or generally to bring this medium to the fore, because you really see the different perspectives and the different forms selfies can take. And in a way, I think it also reveals some of the critical effects, because it displays, you see some selfies here as well, where you can see some, like you really see that people are dedicating all their life to selfies, to making up the perfect image in some social media. But anyway, it inspires reflection, and that I think is what you need to be happy in such a culture. Yeah.
And Will, apart from being an excellently well-timed vehicle for your book, as a sort of a compliment, happy days, but what are your thoughts on dedicating it?
I sort of take it sort of back to Alex's point, really. I think the good thing about all this is it's kind of democratizes photography. I mean, you know, photography is an amazing art form. I'm one of these terrible amateur photographers. You know, when I used to go on holiday with my wife, she used to get to tell me off, like, you're taking too many pictures, oh God. You know, and now it's the other way around. Now she's taking all these pictures. And I think I think we're going to get a really exciting new generation of photographers now who are going to hopefully maybe graduate from the selfie and go on to become really important and amazing photographers. You know, so you don't need to spend 10 grand on Leica anymore if you've got one in your pocket, do you? And I think that's the really exciting thing about what we're seeing around us.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared. And to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Wonderful. Well, thank you all. We're going to throw it open to you guys now. And I think there are some roving microphones, and maybe we'll get the lights up if possible. Anyone have a question for our panel, either to an individual or to the panel in general?
Standing.
Yeah, please, if you could stand, and you can introduce yourself as well if you'd like, but you don't have to.
We want your Instagram handle.
Yeah, we want your Instagram handle.
I'm Nikita. I won't give up my Instagram. How much do you think sort of selfies are just a desperate need for us to have control of our self-image? You talked about it before, how we're not who we perceive ourselves to be, we're rather what people think of us. That's our perception of ourselves is based on what people think of us. So you've got cases of Beyonce. She has been seen to Photoshop some of her Instagram photos of her in selfies, And there was also the case of that photo of her at a concert that she wanted to remove off the internet because it was very unflattering. So how much is this sort of selfie craze just this desperate want to control other people's impressions of ourselves and therefore our definition of ourselves?
Can I take that one?
Kick us off.
I actually have experience with that. I won't go into too much detail because I don't want the person to know that I'm talking about them, but I've taken photos of somebody as a photographer and realized that they had a self-image of which they prefer of themselves, which I was unable to take. And what she would then do is take a selfie of herself in the outfit or whatever we were doing, and then that would be the image that she really liked. And it's quite interesting that you're saying that, and it's a really good paradigm that it's the control of the output. You can't control the photo that somebody else externally takes of you, but the selfie does give you that control to give that image that you have. I mean, it's like the mirror face that we pull. You know, it's almost impossible for anyone to try on shoes and not pull a face when they look in the mirror. Yeah. I mean, I do it, and every time I'm like, why am I doing that? And I've been doing it. But, you know, and I think that the selfie, the way you're discussing it, is kind of that phenomenon exacerbated. Yeah.
Give us your shoe face, Alex.
No, that's not it. No, I have to. You know, I have to look at it to see what it is. I don't actually know what it is. If I did, then I'd pull that face when someone was taking a photo of me.
There's a really interesting experiment. One of my favourite experiments from social psychology, and they did this thing where they tested people, and so they took your picture, a genuine picture of you, and then they took a picture of a really good looking person and a really unattractive person, and they slowly blend it. Mm. And then so there's a series of pictures, and one of you, and there's these you're getting gradually better looking, and these you're getting gradually uglier. And then they ask people which one is the real picture, and they tend to go 10 to 15% better looking than they actually are.
But I mean, that's the normal effect, because we of course surround us with pictures of us where we are extremely good looking.
Yes, exactly. And so yeah, only that's those ones get the cut. It's extraordinary.
We actually look like, which is terrifying.
Yeah, we always say, that's a bad picture of me. People go, no, that's actually, that's what you look like. Yeah.
to the control question, I think, of course, it's the desperate need for control, but in the end, we cannot control the impressions we have on others. So that's where it...
Yeah.
Are there any other questions? There's one at the back there, and I think we've got another mic.
Hi, all the way in the back. Hi, really interesting last bit, like where you guys started talking about the more ethical, like, is it good, is it bad, selfie. I thought that was super interesting because I've never really been confronted or heard anyone ask that question. I think one of the reasons is because, I don't know if you agree, but I feel like we all live in public in the sense that we're all our own mini broadcast stations. No one really bothers, no one under the age of 16 bothers to watch that much TV anymore. Everyone is just constantly Snapchat, Instagram, Tumblr, Facebook. We are essentially a broadcasting station to our viewers, and most of us have a couple hundred people following us. Some people get a couple thousand, you know, and then if you start making money, you know, you understand what I mean? So my question basically is, don't you think selfies are just an organic extension of that thing? You have a baby, you take a picture, everything you do, you broadcast it. So wouldn't that be natural?
I mean, for me, what you describe sounds, I mean, in the book I talk about this idea of the neoliberal self, and it's just an extension of this idea that we kind of become our economy. In a way, and I found this really sinister quote from Margaret Thatcher in 1981. So she was being interviewed.
Margaret Thatcher, sinister, surely not.
But the Sunday Times, and they were like, "So what are you going to do, Maggie?" I don't know if that's the exact question. I'm paraphrasing. And she said, "Oh, you know, what annoys me about our government and our society for the last 30 years is it's been very collective." And she said, "I want to change that. I want to bring sort of individualism back." And the exact quote was, "The method is economics, but the object is to change the soul." And I found that sinister because that's kind of what's happened. Wow. You know, she wanted to turn us all into these little islands of profit and, you know, just like these ancient Greek, you know, individualistic, entrepreneurial people. And that's what we've become. You know, my wife edits Cosmopolitan magazine. And, you know, she says that one of the defining facets of her young female readers is they all want to be entrepreneurs. Mm. They all want to be business people. And I think that's part of it. And that manifests on social media that we all want to be, we're not people anymore. We become our own brands. Mm. and we kind of treat ourselves in that it's like small businesses in a way, and that's that kind of neoliberal self, I think, bubbling to the surface.
And it's also a reality that millennials, just for want of a lazy term, but grouping together, have to. I mean, you talked about having to be a hustler.
This is not a judgment. They have to. This is who they have to be. Yeah, absolutely.
Pandora,
right.
You know, speaking of that generation and someone who is a brand, you are your own brand. You're an incredibly successful journalist and consultant and all the other things, but you are also a brand in yourself. How do you respond to that?
It's a terrible modern phenomenon, the brand, isn't it? Like content, I think they've just
ban those words.
No, but as in it's you know, it's true. You always have people go, I need to get content, or that's not on brand, or brand alignment, or any of that. And it's all pretty awful. But you're right, the labels exist for a reason. I think on the hustler note, and Will saying you have to be definitely as a journalist who is 30 rather than, I don't know, 45 or 50, so a generation older. I'm not saying any of you at any ages. Just if I was a journalist who was 45 or 50, and is that there, you have to be doing more than one thing. You cannot make very much money as if you are just doing one thing. You know, I adore print journalism as much as I do digital, but there is increasingly less money. You hear of magazines folding and combining weekly. Yeah. So you have to also exist online as well. And you have to think, how can I do the work I do and talk about what I'm interested in on different formats, which is why I started a podcast, because we're in quite an audio phase at the moment. But yeah, definitely, I think you have to hustle, and you have to be, in that sense, depressingly quite individualistic. I still find it terrifying how many people are setting up businesses, because, you know, 90% of startups fail. Mm. But I also think it's really encouraging that we are now definitely, probably sometimes to the detriment and slightly unrealistically, but you're very much encouraged to, you know, find your USP. It's all acronyms now. Find your USP, take your MO.
Let's get another question from the floor here. Thank you very much for your patience.
I'd be curious to hear what you have to say about vlogging, because vlogging in of itself is like selfie in long form with high production value. And it's very much, in a way, you could say narcissistic, because it is about the person and their lives. I'd be curious to hear what you think, how that's going to go, because it is something that's growing massively on YouTube.
Vlogging goes back to that idea that we're all just mini broadcasting stations. Any thoughts, Will?
Yeah, I actually was recently in YouTube's sort of vlogging HQ near St Pancras Station in London. And again, you know, going back to the idea of kind of neoliberalism again. I mean, I think one of the things that sort of worried me about that whole scene was that, you know, back in the day, in the good old days, if you wanted to be a TV presenter, you'd get an agent, a big structure of people around you, you'd get paid really well, etc. And now what I was seeing with these vloggers is that they have to do it all themselves, that the hair and makeup, they have to learn how to be a director, they have to, you know, develop all their own content. And I was talking to one young woman in particular, like really talented young woman. She had zillions of followers on YouTube, and you can't even get into this place unless you have 10,000 subscribers. That's the minimum requirement, and then you get more and more time in their studios, depending on how many. And she was one of their sort of big stars, and she was a musician. And I was just there, just with the assumption she was massively successful and probably really rich. And then it slipped out that she lives with her dad. And I said, so why are you living with your dad? And she went, you don't make much money, you know. And I was like, do you not? And she said, no. These days, you know, you have to become famous before you get the record deal. Like, whereas, you know, 20 years ago, you'd get a record deal. I had friends that I grew up with that got £250,000.
We've got time probably for one or two more questions here in the nearly the front. Thank you.
Hi. There's one theme that constantly comes up to me when I think of selfie and social media is surveillance. So for me, social media is almost like a manifestation of Bentham's panopticon prison system, where we're incarcerating ourselves in constant surveillance. I'm surveilling myself, I'm surveilling you, everyone's surveilling us. So do you think the obsession with self-fashioning is more of a desperate expression of self-expression and fear of anonymity, like Miss Pandora said, in a world full of noise? Or is it more of people seeking external confirmation that they are a valid part of their chosen in-group?
That's a very, very good question. I'm going to throw it to you, Sarah, first, to give the sort of psychologist's take.
Yeah, this is part of it. We did some studies where we also explored the relations between the individual strategies that people use for self-presentation, just in a general way, and selfie-taking. And what we found was that people who score high on self-promotion, which means for them a usual strategy to present themselves is talk about their benefits, their positive attributes, those are also very active selfie takers and are feeling good while taking selfies. But also people who are type of self-disclosure, so who really show their emotions as a way to get positive feedback from others, to be liked by others. And I think this control aspect could also be some of this. So I think there's not the one reason why we take selfies, but that's definitely part of it. And I think this is also the big challenge then, to see whether, yeah, the way you use selfies are really feeding what you need. And also the question we had before, whether it's art or it's self-presentation or what it is, I think it's often a mixture of different needs that come together. But you just have to be aware that the goal you have in mind, for example, like making a perfect impression on others or being liked by others, this is maybe not what you will get, because the picture will be perceived different than you expect.
Fascinating. I think we're going to have to wrap things up. We're just thinking about answering human needs. One of the extraordinary pieces of data that I found when I was researching this was that the more selfies you take, the amount of selfies you take is in sort of direct proportion to how little sex you have. So the more selfies you have, you take, the less sex you have, which... go ponder, people. Thank you so much to our wonderful panel, Will Straw, Sarah Diefenbach, Pandora Sykes, and Alex Lambrecht. I wanted to point out that all of the proceeds from tonight's event are going to be donated to the British Red Cross's London Fire Relief Fund. That's supporting people who've been injured, bereaved, or left homeless by the Grenfell Tower disaster, which of course took place in this very borough. So thank you all for being here and contributing to that. Thank you ever so much for being here, and have a lovely rest of your night.